In my career, I caught lots of shiny Pokemon, and I come from a normal family. So, like, I worked overdrive and had this ambition and this ferocious drive to always go to the next and to the next and to the next. And it was only when I got to the top of my mountain that I realized that it was rubbish. It didn't feel like society had told me it would feel. What was driving me to be exceptional was that I honestly thought that if I could show everybody how exceptional I was, then I'd be loved.
So I'm joined today by Stephanie Antonian, who is the founder and CEO of Astora, an AI research lab focused on love. Stephanie has previously worked for Google DeepMind as an ethics consultant and also at Google X. She holds a master's in biblical studies from St. Andrews and a master's in public policy from Harvard University. Stephanie, what an impressive and interesting journey you've obviously had so far. Thank you so much for speaking today.
Thank you for having me.
So, yeah, as I mentioned, you've done a lot of interesting things, you know, both academically and actually, you know, career-wise. Can you start by connecting the dots of all of these and trying to kind of explain how each of these experiences led to each other and to where you are now?
Yeah, that's a good question. So they seem quite disparate, but I think when I look back at it, it all makes a bit more sense in just searching for meaning or someone who had answers. So when I was young, I grew up Catholic and went to convent school and became very Catholic and wanted to study that more. So studied, did my degree in the Bible, but had more questions than answers. Like, why can't I be the Pope? Then decided to go into business because it was the recession and it felt like business was where it was at. So I went to Accenture and then joined Google strategy team after that. But I realized that actually a lot of business doesn't know what's going on. Like, it was such a shock to realize that most companies don't actually know their exact profit figure, which was wild. So then I thought, okay, well, I'll go to government because business is probably all about money and government and policy. They know, they care and they know what's up. So then I went to the Kennedy School and specialized in data privacy and realized that it's also not perfect there. Like, in business, people like money, but in government, people like dominionship.
So let's start with like what you're doing now. So you're the CEO and founder of Astora. And as I've already mentioned, kind of tagline is, an AI research lab focused on love.
Yeah.
So what is Astora and what do you mean by that exactly?
Okay, cool. So at Astora, we research the system dynamics of AI and innovation in the market and look at where things are and aren't loving. And then we design AI products to intervene. So where this all came about is through all of these experiences, what I realized is that we intervene on the level of action, but under actions are thoughts and under thoughts are emotions. And whether we like it or not, the human experience is based on emotion. We are emotional creatures and some emotions are better than others. So the AI industry right now is largely focused on pushing people to more negative emotions. And it's unintelligent, but, you know, algorithms on Instagram, they're not focused on self-actualizations. They want you to click more. And they've worked out that if you feel worse about yourself, you'll click more. And so we focus on asking a different question, which is, how could we build AI to move people from fear to love? And what would that look like if the goal of technology was to help people move to self-actualization and move to more loving states? And so it's a big question and there's not one solution, but we are just launching our first product, which we're very excited about.
Do you want to tell us a bit about that product?
Yeah, so we research lots of different areas and write essays about where things might be going wrong. And one of the biggest issues that we're facing now is what's happening with our children and with the next generation, as we've unleashed all these algorithms out into the wild that prey on negative emotions and push people to more negative states. And lots of conversations are happening about how we protect children and child safety, but it's ultimately driven by organizations with fiduciary responsibilities to continue making profit. And in all of the complexity, we lose sight of actual potential solutions. So our solution is called a digital health score, and it's a 1 to 5 green to red score that shows a user the likely psychological impact of their online content consumption. So that's what it is. We tested it with students at UCL and King's and Bristol, and this is our second edition now that we're about to launch.
So would the plan be to eventually like have this as a like easy to use app or browser extension that like, you know, anyone in any country could use, like anywhere? Is the plan to make it kind of big scale?
We're starting with English speaking countries and with browser, because we need to make sure that we're that the model works and that we're accurately detecting the emotional intensity. But the idea is that we're putting out a totally new way of thinking about this problem, where the goal is purely to increase agency to users. And I think we're in a tough spot now, because either something needs to be commercial and directly for profit with the current advertising model, or it needs to be regulation. Whereas actually there's this whole range of middleware and solutions that are product-based but regulatory in spirit. And that's what will help us create the protections that we need to get the best of tech.
This scale that you, this 1 to 5 scale that you kind of rate pieces of content on to, I guess, determine, the extent to which it's influencing positively or negatively their well-being. Can you talk about that? I'm intrigued how you've gone about designing that scale, the research you've done into kind of it, any philosophical, I guess, considerations into like what's important for happiness and well-being and things like this.
Yeah, so a lot has gone into it, and it's taken years. And the first thing is that it's a 1 to 5 scale, but it's not on positivity to negativity. So happy people, or actually, I don't really like to use the word happy because it's a bit misleading, but fulfilled people see negative things. They go through negative emotions. So getting the top score means, or a score of 1, means that in the day, week, or month, what you saw was in line to what a normal person can cope with. Getting the worst score, which is a 5, shows that what you have been exposed to in the day, week, or month is very unlikely that someone would be able to process that and stay mentally healthy. So that's our range. So it's not you only saw great stuff today, you're only clicking on puppies, right? It's more of, okay, you had a balanced experience versus you didn't. And the idea from it came after me reading about Moy Russell, who is the British teenager who committed suicide, and it was death by social media. And when I read that, it was like, whoa, this is awful on every single count, not just what happened to her, but also the reaction from the industry to gaslight the parents is just wild. Like, it was just unbelievable. And it was... what we were thinking about is, how do you actually design an intervention that can give users, children, and then potentially parents, some way to see how aligned with reality they are, or whether they've just dropped off into just total darkness. I read somewhere once, and it said that when you're in the darkness, you don't need to analyze darkness. That doesn't help. You don't need more data on darkness. You have to turn on the light. I think one of the biggest problems that we have now is that no one knows what people are seeing. It's a bit like food back in the day when we all used to eat junk food all day long, so we didn't really know how bad it was. And right now, users don't know, governments don't know, and the techies don't know what people are actually seeing and consuming. And so just something that can shine the light to show you roughly where you are is going to be helpful. And it's not 200 pages of terms and conditions, or here's all the URLs you visited, or here's all the URLs your child visited, now spend 7 hours also to see what you think about it, but just a quick, this is where you are, this is the situation you're in, would be helpful.
So essentially it's like when you grab a food packet.
Exactly.
And it has a rating. This is a great idea.
It's so simple.
It's so simple. I'm now thinking, of course, this is one of those ideas where you think, of course, this makes sense. Do you think that can you imagine a point where, you know, the providers of like technology services would be required to have like built into their site, or you'd have to use an app right on the site, something like this. So you'd always know, because it's required on food packaging. Is this what you're kind of hoping to get to at one point?
Potentially. So it is very similar to food. And actually in every field where there's ambiguity and uncertainty, we just create a rating system. So we have it with cinema, we have it with energy, we have it with schools, we have it with food. Like, we know how you deal with ambiguity, and you just give people a simple red light system. We just haven't done it for the internet, which is crazy. But what happened with food was that it was actually the food industry that adopted those labels, because there was going to be huge amounts of regulation. And so I don't think that tech companies will need to be forced to do it, but I think they are increasingly struggling at solving these problems. They do not have the space to create the interventions required, and their alternative is getting shut down. And so innovations in this field that could allow people to have confidence, that could get the best out of the technology while keeping it, would be great. So I would hope that one day, as this product evolves, they choose to voluntarily put this on their platforms and give users the ability to see cross-platform how they manage things and to have that accountability too.
Why is it that you wouldn't want to get this kind of legally enforced at one point, like it is the case, I guess, with cosmetics and food and these other things, as opposed to like a voluntary thing?
It's not, I don't think it's legally for food. It could be regulatory. I guess I don't have distinct views on where it has to go. And I have spent a lot of time in the tech sector, and I do feel like a lot of people really do want solutions, and they would put measures in place if they had them and they'd been developed in certain ways, and you could actually generate a cost benefit that worked. So maybe I'm a bit more hopeful of it. Maybe a bit too hopeful, but it can be regulation. It's just, it's better when interventions aren't forced.
It'd be good to dive a little bit deeper back into that kind of the scale again, though. Like, so what are some of the kind of considerations that help you determine, I guess, the score that someone would kind of find after a day of browsing different content? What kind of positive or negative aspects of content that kind of influence people's well-being?
Like I said at the beginning, that a store is based on this premise that all humans operate on emotion. And so what we do is we scan your content that you're seeing, not like your personal content, but the content that you're seeing. And we're looking at the emotional intensity and what emotion it's trying to trigger from a user. So most of the industry is looking at whether something is real or fake. And that's the big security threat that we have to understand. If it's misinformation, it's disinformation, where it's coming from. But defining truth is sort of too big a task on the to-do list before we protect kids. Like, we've not done that since the history of time. And while it is a noble pursuit, it can't be a necessary requirement before we stop showing ridiculous stuff to young people. So what we look at instead is we bypass all of that and we say, what emotion is this trying to get from you? We don't know if it's getting that emotion from you or not. Just like you can eat foods that have high ratings and have a great weight. Like, you know, people can use their own intelligence to work out what the true fit for them is. But what we're looking at is, what does this want to get from you? And typically, it will weed out misinformation, disinformation, because they have an aim. It's not just to confuse you. It's also to provoke emotions. And they happen to be some of the most emotive pieces out there. But that's what we're looking at. So are you reading stuff that's trying to make you hate your body? And are you doing this all the time? Because it's very unlikely that you'll be looking in the mirror after and being like, I look great. It's more likely you'll be like, actually, I'm going to skip this meal or harm myself. And so that's the key piece that we're looking at, the emotional intensity and the manipulation attempts. And there's been a lot of work underneath the surface, especially with the sentiment analysis piece, because most sentiment analysis is actually done for sales. So it's, how do I exploit somebody's emotions to get them to buy? So you have really big things missing, like shame or just peace or the actual things that impact somebody's fulfillment. So we've had to do a lot of work with that. And we've had to do a lot of work behind the scenes to get the models working. But we are launching this second go, and we would love anybody to get involved who would like to join us on this.
So with like new technologies kind of coming out, VR and AI and this kind of thing, what are your concerns around social media in like 5 years from now? Do you think we'll be even more addicted, even more depressed? Like, what do you think about the future of the effects of this stuff on us?
I think that no one knows, because we don't know what the next generation are exposed to. So I think in the Industrial Revolution, the family nuclearized, and that was a big defining moment in like modern history. And in this revolution, the family's atomized. So you can have a house and you can have your child upstairs, and there's actually nothing you can do now to protect them. And they will spend between 5 and 7 hours watching content that you don't know. And even the government doesn't know. So we don't know the true impact that will have on the next generation, because no one's come up with a way to monitor at scale in a simple, efficient manner what on earth is going on. So the other thing that the Digital Health Score gives is just a population view of how bad the situation is. Which is something that could really help in those predictions on how bad this situation actually is. Like, for all you know, your child could be watching maths videos, in which case we would have really good, it would be great. Like, if they're self-teaching upstairs, that's fantastic. Like, if they're doing affirmations, that's great. I mean, we don't know. Based on the mental health state and how it's declining, we have some indicators that that's not what's happening. But ultimately, the biggest problem is that no one knows what's happening to the next generation.
Apart from this, are you working on any other products at the moment? Maybe you can't speak about some of these, but is I'm just intrigued about like the plan of a store in general. So it's to think through things and then just release these if you think it's a good enough idea as a product.
Yeah, to then become its own business. So similar to the X model, which is lots of ideas, develop them in-house and then spin them off. So we have lots of ideas, and then we'll put out publicly essays, and then there's typically an idea at the end. So some is on financial redistribution, how you solve for truth with LLMs and ideas like that, that we're not directly pursuing, but they were interesting enough to put out to the public. And then the ideas and products that we're pursuing will be put out once it's all patented and once we can actually do that. So there are more, but other than what is put on the website, we can't share that. But the idea is just, if you asked a different question about AI and what it could do, you would get totally different innovations that seem so obvious, but were never thought of because we never asked the question. So if you said, how do we build AI that could help humans be more themselves, and then took the problem space of child safety or algorithmic bias or financial redistribution, you would come up with a totally different answer. And so it's a great time to play in this space because it's empty.
And like across all of the products you're working on, thinking about, you've got this idea of love, you know, focused on love. How do you understand, what is love to you?
That's a very good question. So when I talk about love, I mean a love of life and a love of humanity. And I thought you might ask me that this morning. And I thought, oh gosh, how am I going to define love? Because it's so undescribable. But I think for me, it means a reverence to just the magnificence of humanity.
You talk about, you know, most social media and other kind of companies at the moment aim more at fear. Why are we in this situation? Why are people, unlike Astora, focusing more on you know, driving engagement through fear than love? If love is seems something that's actually possible with technology products, why are we stuck in this bad place?
When I was in the AI ethics space, it felt so uncomfortable. But I didn't have the words to describe it. And basically, we have anchored the entire AI conversation on the assumption that AI will be awful. And so let's make it less awful. So like even the AI safety space is like, oh, AI is going to be awful, but how do we save something? How do we make something safe? And same with the ethics one, like it's going to be bad, but how do we make it less bad? And so I hadn't even paid attention to the fact that I was just drawn in to the conversation that just assumes it's going to be bad and then was using all my energy to say, how do I make it less bad? Instead of just saying, well, actually, it might not be bad. How do I focus all my energy on what it could be like if it was good? And so there's a lot that's spoken about in the ideas of like, you have to invest in the seven deadly sins to make money. Like it's also the incentive model that we have behind, like you want to start talking about AI and love, people think you're cuckoo. But the money isn't there. It's really focused on this fear mongering place and the seven deadly sins, and that's fine. That's not bad. It's just, we were always meant to have a counterbalance. So, you know, it's good to have people thinking about how to make it less bad, but it would also be good to have people thinking about the other space. Like we need some form of counterbalance. So that's what had happened, is that I realized that I was just always thinking about how to make AI less bad. And in that, I had decided that I agreed that AI was going to be awful.
So you kind of stepped outside of that way that everyone's thinking. But why do you think that most people are thinking that in the first place? Why is everyone thinking, let's make it less bad, less bad, less bad? And you stepped outside and said, here's how to make it, you know, loving and great. Why are most people primed to go the other way?
I think because it, like the whole AI narrative exploits fear. So I love it when people say like, oh, AI is rational, we need a rational approach. It's like, AI couldn't be more hysterical. Like, this is the whole AI industry is just histrionics. Like, this is ridiculous. It's the entire argument is humanity is flawed and has made all these problems, and so we have to create this technology that might save us, but then it might realize that we're flawed, and if it does, it's going to harm us. And it's like, okay, that is self-hatred personified, and that's definitely not rationality. But because we don't step back and look at what the argument is, it's like we go straight into irrational thinking and just split second rule of thumb thinking in that primal mind, and then we have to protect ourselves because there's this big narrative that's just like, danger's coming, and so we rush to protect ourselves because it's so all-encompassing and it's just so much. And then, and that's not a criticism in that, like, it's happening. It's really intense, the messaging about AI being negative. People who are saying that AI is not going to be negative or doesn't have to be are just generally silenced. It's not that they aren't saying that. It's just that they don't get the most clicks because anxious people click the most. And then we all intuitively feel that things are getting worse. I mean, I know the statistics seem to say that everything's great because, like, you know, you can count 0-hour contracts as employed, but everybody feels that cost of things are going up and life's getting harder and people are getting fired left, right, and center. So I think intuitively people have worked out that things are getting worse, and we go into these negative, anxious states and into like this anxious nervous system, and it requires an actual intervention to move somebody out of that. You can't just come out of that separately, but like the media and the mass, like, it's not going to happen because it's intentional. The fear-based narrative is intentional to get everybody to agree to this new system without them being able to think that it might not actually benefit them.
Why do you think people are afraid to, yeah, I guess, admit that love is the answer?
Okay, that's a big question, and I can't really speak for other people, but I can say for myself that basically, in my career, I caught lots of shiny Pokemon, and I come from a normal family. So like, I worked overdrive and had this ambition and this ferocious drive to always go to the next and to the next and to the next. And it was only when I got to the top of my mountain, like what I had set as like totally amazing for me, that I realized that it was rubbish, and it wasn't giving me the life that I actually wanted. It didn't feel like society had told me it would feel. Like, I did everything right for what society said. Like, I did what society said was exceptional in education and in my career. I had the partner who society said, like, should have been great. Like, everything looked great, but it felt rubbish. Like, I didn't feel good about myself. And then I was speaking to one of my friends about it, and he said something so profound. So he basically just said, like, if you win the rat race, you're just a fat rat alone. And I was like, oh, like, what was driving me to be exceptional was that I honestly thought that if I could show everybody how exceptional I was, then I'd be loved, or like part of the community, I'd be wanted. And actually, that's totally the opposite way. Like, and then it was only when I let go of all of that and I realized that there was nothing exceptional about me, that I was just, you know, like everybody else. And then, you know, everyone's a genius or no one's a genius. And like, it was all together that I actually got what I wanted, because then it was like, oh, if we're all the same, then I am lovable because everyone else is. Like, I don't need to do something for it. And that was a huge shift in my life, that realization, because then it meant that I never had to prove anything, but I could just pursue what was interesting to me, like as an offering. So a story was set up with like these essays and things. They're just offerings. They don't have direct incentives. They don't have commercial aims. It's just, you know, these are the talents, and it's an offering. And that was a huge shift. And to get there, there was a lot of grieving because everything I'd been told is wrong. So that's, you know, maybe why other people aren't naturally going to go down that route, because we train people from birth to go down this route. We train them that if you reach these levels, then everything would be good. And if you don't, you won't be worthy. So I don't think it's any individual's fault. It's just collectively, that's where we're sending everybody to, even though it doesn't lead us to what we want.
Let's talk about your story. So, yeah, starting with university. So you went to Edinburgh, did this biblical studies master. St. Andrews.
Yeah.
And then went to Harvard and did a master's there in public policy. So can you talk me through a bit about that time, what you learned, why you decided to do biblical studies at the start, and maybe how all this kind of set you up for what was to come? And
yeah, so when I was a teenager, I went to Catholic school and I got really into Catholicism. And then the more I studied it, the more I thought I wasn't, like, I had a few too many questions. I'd considered becoming a nun, but then I realized I didn't want to be a nun for the right reasons. I wasn't, like, I didn't feel called to be a nun. I just didn't want to deal with any of the ambiguity of, like, having to get a job or get married or be a mean person. Because, you know, when you're a teenager, like, you see the world and you realize, oh, it's a bit messy here, and I don't want to contribute to the mess. But I always stayed interested in religion, and I thought Jesus was pretty cool. Whether he was divine or not didn't really bother me, but I was like, that is a spicy way to live. like, shocking, really. And it's so funny because, okay, so I studied biblical studies, I did all this stuff, and it was only in my 30s that I realized Jesus got crucified.
You didn't know the story?
I knew it. Yeah, okay. I knew the story.
Didn't understand the message of it?
I'd thought, oh, if I live a good Christian life, then everything will be easy. And it's all the, like, WWJD, what would Jesus do? And you think it's going to lead you to an easy life. Whereas it actually led the man to get crucified. Because I was like, why is this hard when I'm trying to pursue love? Why is this so hard? Like, why am I getting beaten up for trying to pursue, like, love and kindness and stuff? I'm like, man got crucified. Oh gosh, like, the penny hadn't dropped that actually, like, pursuing love is not peaceful. But I digress. And so I went to St. Andrews. I found it really interesting. And then I specialized in the first century economy in the Gospel of Matthew and thought it was so interesting. And then I just wanted to understand, like, about wealth and what it means to live a good life and what the teachings were and how rich the actual congregation was at the time and, like, what was going on with the banking system. So very niche. And then I went to Accenture from that. So I went to consulting, which, you know, my industry, so I was like, oh, Bible's best selling book of all time. like no one does expansion like Catholicism. So actually the parallels were the same. And then when I was at Accenture and at Google, I started realizing about data privacy and how that was going to be a big issue. And this was still back in the day. This was like 2013, 14. And then started looking more into that. And that's also what moved me into policy. And that's why I did the degree in public policy. And that was awesome. The Kennedy School was amazing. I highly recommend it if anybody's thinking about it. And that was where I learned a bit about economics, policy, stats, all the core curriculum, and then the tech policy. And I was a researcher at the law school on data privacy law, and it's just very interesting. It's like Disneyland for nerds there. Like, you can go into anything, you can subscribe to classes at any of the schools, and it's just fascinating. And yeah.
Going to Harvard was great, as you say, but did that help? That can't, obviously a highly prestigious, you know, world famous university. Was that another thing that really pushed you into the rat race and feel like you've really got to keep achieving, you know, after you go to Harvard? Yeah. I wonder if that had any like influence on
I had a great crowd at Harvard, and I had this wonderful professor, Jim Waldo, like, so incredible. If anyone can ever take any of his classes, I highly recommend it. And he was just really incredible on developing people as people. So he was like, you know, your self-esteem's too low, you're putting up with all this rubbish from these companies, you need to get a backbone, basically, which I wasn't ready to hear at the time. I was like, no, I can make myself smaller, I can go lower. But it's a very ambitious place, but it sort of is the American dream, which I understand, like, it's hard to live the American dream and stuff, but it's like, you also meet normal people there, and they just normalize that you can achieve something. So it wasn't like you had to get the most prestigious job, and especially the Kennedy School is much more relaxed, and it's much more open-ended where people go, and it's very good for dealing with ambiguity, which is why I recommend it. Initially, I thought I'd go to the business school, but it was the best thing ever to go to the Kennedy School, precisely because it's not so dogged about that, and it gives you space and helps you deal with that awkwardness. So it wasn't, okay, I was taking a really long way to answer your question, but basically it wasn't mega overachieving in the way that other schools might have been, but it really like healed you to think that maybe you could do something. Because it just normalizes people. Like, even you met politicians, yeah? I met Ed Balls, which I'd only ever seen Ed Balls on TV or on newspapers. And it's like, oh, wow, you look like a normal human. But you just meet people and realize that they're humans too, which sounds silly. But if you don't come from the world where everybody's mega successful, that is like psychologically such a, like, like it opens your mind up.
So in the sense, maybe that actually takes the pressure off, like, wanting to become like one of these supposed superstars a little bit, because you actually see that they're more human. So it actually reduces the chance that you aspire to be like this great figure, potentially.
It depends on the school. Like, I took a class called Reimagining Capitalism at the business school, and I was like, this is awful. And I can see that you're under a lot of pressure to become like a CEO, whereas the Kennedy School is not. It still hasn't found its niche identity. I'm sure in 30 years it'll be different, but now it was like, it was just much more real.
Yeah. So you went to Harvard, then went to Accenture, then went to Google, and then you got to Google DeepMind. And then, so you moved from there to Google X.
Yeah, so I took a break in between those two and was a carer. But Google X, or X, the Moonshot Factory, that was the wacky division of Google, from sort of more famous back in the day. But it was the moonshot, so like the really out there thinking, like the smart glasses, the driverless cars, or like Google Brain or Chronicle, and the stratospheric balloons for internet. just the really wacky stuff. And then I joined on the policy team and then went to the business team and then to the marketing team. So it was just sort of like a fly in the wall and then product. Because I worked remotely in London as a contractor so that I didn't have to go live in America. And then just, yeah, spent like more than 4 years there just from team to team, doing a bit of everything really.
Those products, glasses and cars and so on, are they some of the things you worked on? I'm intrigued, any particular projects that you worked on that were interesting?
No, I didn't work on any of those projects. So I don't really think I can talk about them on the detailed project.
Or secretive, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, yeah, in between DeepMind and X, as you talked about, you were a carer at one point, I believe, for your father. Be good to hear a bit about that because, you know, and the extent to which maybe this was quite a formative period for you. Because I think, the one thing I guess I want to kind of ask and dig a bit deeper into now and get the sense of is it just feels like you maybe lived, there was just a point where things shifted quite a lot. Yeah. You know, you're in this world for a while and you've now, you know, more of the fear world. And then there was a moment where you leave more into the love world.
Exactly.
So maybe this was one of the most important experiences of that. So
I had a relationship breakdown and then I realized my dad was going to die. And that all happened in like a couple of months. And it was sort of like, oh, how the mighty have fallen. You know, like the year before, it was like, I was in love. I was at DeepMind. I was on a fellowship at Harvard. Everyone was alive. And then it was like, okay, I'm unemployed. I'm single. I'm in my 30s. I'm living at home and I'm caring for someone who is going to die. Yeah, that was quite a change. And it was like all of the things I've built my identity on, it just crumbled. And then it was just about what I actually wanted to do, I don't mean this is like a silly way. I didn't know what else to strive for because I'd reached my pinnacle. So it's like, I didn't know what was meant to look good on my CV next or what I didn't know how to stay in the game. And so that was like sort of freeing because it was like, I don't actually want to. I want to be here with my dad. So yeah, moved back home because, you know, you don't really make money when you're like being carer. And then I was just there. And that was it like totally changed my perception of everything. And it was like day to night, we were talking about it before. I was like, you know, before I was like, I'm going to save the world. And then it was like, wow, I can do everything in my power. I can't even save my dad. And it really shaped what was important. I'd never really seen death. So even when palliative care were there and they were telling me like, oh, you know, he'll have to have injections for his medicine. It was like, it didn't make sense to me until it happened that like you lose the ability to swallow. Like I didn't know any of these things. And it gave a very different perspective on everything. And it was a bit like I didn't go into living in the present from peace and love. Like it was more like everything fell apart and there was nothing else. A bit like if you've had an accident and they put those things on your head and you've got to stay like when you're on the stretcher so that you can only look forward. It was like, oh, the past was so painful and the future was even more painful. So it was like, okay, in this moment, what am I going to do? Because before I'd always be like, if I do X, then I'll get Y. If I work here, then I'll have this opportunity. If I go to Harvard, I'll get this and blah, 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 blah. And then it was just like everything was so painful that it was just like I can only be here in this moment. And that was the shift. So it wasn't like, yay, lucky me, I'm loved.
Was that experience with your dad, like, do you think it was one of like the first times where you'd really actually experienced, you know, things around death and you know, saving people and things around well-being that before had just always been in the abstract, talked about, written about, and it was just like the first time embodied you'd actually gone through it?
Yeah, it had changed it because then I saw something that said like, oh, statistics doesn't matter to the individual. And when you're in the AI space, you're always talking about statistics as if it's not a human. And what my dad had was his body just stopped making red blood cells, so it's super rare. But it doesn't matter because that happened to him. And it was just it had all been so abstract on this vision of what humanity was and what was important. And it was also, it was a very difficult time, but it was also an incredibly fulfilling time, which sounds a bit weird, but I'd read somewhere, actually I went to this talk from Peter Vide when I was a teenager and it really stuck, and he was saying that you should never try to be happy because happiness is fleeting, you can't control it. But you should strive for fulfillment, because even when things are really bad, you can always ask yourself, what do I need to do in this moment to be fulfilled? And you have total agency over that. And so it was like, this is an awful time, but actually there are these actions I can do to make it fulfilling. And it was a very meaningful time, which also threw me. It was sort of, I had never really embraced pain and grief to know that it's sort of good. It's like gets that like heart involved in the way that I thought would if I was like, oh, I'm so smart, everybody look at my CV. So it had made everything real in a way that had made the AI stuff so abstract. And it's a bit of a long story. Okay, so basically, this is also random, but I signed up to go to this course, to go to Bhutan, to learn about the Gross National Happiness Index. And it was for alumni, and it was after graduating and stuff. And it was the January when everything had imploded. And in Bhutan, they just have a very different view on death. And they're very peaceful about it. And they'll talk about it so openly in a way that like we don't. And there happened to be someone who had been in my class at Harvard whose ex-girlfriend's mum had had the same thing as my dad. And he was like, oh, she died within 5 months. And a painful death, like in the hospital. And then I was sitting and there was this guy from the medical school who's like one of the smartest men I've ever met in my life. And we had a conversation about it and he was like, your dad is going to die within 6 months. And it was so silent and it was so peaceful. And it was like, okay, all right, this is happening. And it was New Year's as well. And it was like, I'm about to go home and life is going to be so different. Like now I'm in this magical land, but like I'm about to be caring and with no future employment like prospect. But nobody in the UK ever told me how long my dad would live. And my mum, my sister, they didn't go to Bhutan. They didn't have that silent, calm conversation. And so they didn't actually know he was going to die, because you don't believe it, like because you want to believe something else. And one of the worst things about being a carer that I experienced was that you don't really get any help in planning or managing your time. So it's like, could last 3 days, 3 months, 3 years. You have no idea. So like, do you leave your job? Do you take your holiday? Like, how do you manage that? Like, you don't get that. But because I'd had this conversation, I was like, okay, 6 months, I'm leaving my job. I'm not going to work. I'm just going to focus on this. And he died within 5. And that was the piece of information that I needed, that we won't tell people in our culture. We don't want to tell people when they're going to die, when we think they're going to die, because of liability, because sometimes it doesn't work, because of all these things. And so it's sort of like leading back to the AI piece is like, is AI ever going to tell you what you really want to know, which is, well, how long does this person have left? Or like, how do I manage these things? Or is it just going to tell you, by the way, you didn't sleep last night? I thought I didn't know that. I knew that I didn't sleep well, right? I know how, if I've overeaten. I mean, I can get that. But there are these major things in life that we all desperately want to know that we won't tell you. So what does it matter? So yeah, that's a long way to basically say that it just, like, life and death and what it means to live and what it means to live a good life and to enjoy life and all that had been abstract when I was working in AI more intensely. And then AI became super abstract when I was actually living and participating in what was meaningful, and it just didn't matter as much anymore, the AI stuff.
Interesting, because we said before the conversation, you talked about some people at X Moonshot Factory, that is, like a lot older and have had more life experiences.
Yeah.
You think working on technology and doing anything really after you've gone for a proper life is probably a better way to do it.
Yeah, and even because I actually ended up at X after being a carer, so I thought I'd given up my whole career. But then they were like, oh, we really like people who have great CVs who blow it all up for something more important, which you don't know at the time. But that was, they were just like, oh, cool, you have actually more important priorities, like to live like a more meaningful life. So great. I was like, oh, I didn't see that one coming. But it was just, my experience was just, it was a very loving place there and very nurturing. And it was like, you know, I was obviously on the floor from everything that I'd experienced, hadn't made sense of. And it was like just a giant hug. And my experience, like, it was working with the most incredible people who had really high self-esteem and was so loving.
Well, see, you're a very deep thinker. You know, you're very knowledgeable. I'm intrigued, like, what you consume that kind of inspires you and, you know, guides your thinking and what you write and work on. Like, you know, books-wise, reading-wise, is there any... What do you read, basically?
Well, so I think that if you want to ever say something profound, you never need to say something new. You just need to say something that's established wisdom in a new way. So like, nothing I have ever written about is new. It's just newly applied to tech. So I read an eclectic mix. So I just read C.S. Lewis. It's a short book on grieving about when his wife died, which was like, whoa. And then I'm rereading this book that I read as a teenager that really struck me from Peter Vardy called Being Human. And then I read a lot of philosophy and some science book, like reading something about white holes, that's cool. And then woo-woo books about love. But lots of them are philosophical. I read Fromm's The Art of Loving on holiday. And just, I guess the main thing that I was reading in the last 5 years is what's this love stuff all about? Because when I made that shift, things actually started to feel really nice. And then I listened to this book from Robert Holden. It got a bit too woo-woo for me, but it was about on what your life goal is. And he was like, everyone has the same goal in life, which is to learn how to love and be loved. And that should be your career goal because it makes everything simple. And then it doesn't matter if you have this job or that job. And if it moves and stuff, it's much more robust. And I was like, that's nice. Yeah, nice. And that, yeah, I'd never really had that. And I was like, oh, okay. And then I read stuff about, well, how do you build self-esteem, or how do you let go of an inverted ego where you want to save the world, you want to save people, and read lots of books about psychology. And that was just, I was just trying to consume as much as possible. I listened to loads of audiobooks. I'm reading Emma Gilchrist's The Master and His Emissary, but it's just taking me a little bit of time, you know, because I've had lots of really good ideas. I've got to consume that, like, seriously. So... I like to read the books that talk about how we might be thinking, how things might be different and how they might link to love, which is most of the great books, actually. But it's hard because I still need to hear the message repeated. Because even though I'm like, oh, yeah, love is the answer, the penny still hasn't 100% dropped, so I like to listen to books that talk about it in a new way, even though they're all saying the same thing in a new way, to just try to get it to land. So, yeah, some of the philosophy stuff is probably the best.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Okay, and as a final question, so I don't know if you know this, but I actually ask every guest the same question at the end of each episode. I think you're a good person to ask this. So the question, final question is, yeah, what do you think it means to live a good life?
Oh, I think it means to love and be loved. I really think that if I was honest with myself, that's all I really wanted. Aside from the baseline, you know, shelter, food, that ultimately it's just to belong and love. It's sort of crazy in that it's such a a simplistic, loving answer, but that is sort of Maslow's hierarchy of needs as well. It's always repeated as the answer. We just don't like it. But I think that's what living well means, loving well.
There's many more things I'd love to ask you, some of your essays, so maybe perhaps we could chat again at another
always.
Point. But thank you so much. This has been really inspiring and interesting. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for watching this episode. If you enjoyed it, please consider hitting the subscribe button below, and I hope to see you here again.